Schopenhauer believed that the world would someday acknowledge the truth of his views, but not, he felt, till after his death. Schopenhauer is famous for his pessimism. Given the happy ending to his life, we might suppose his reputation for pessimism was unjustified. But this judgment considers pessimism as a personality trait. Consider the question, is the glass half full or half empty? The optimist brings the half-full glass to the banquet and praises both the host and the company. The pessimist points to a half-empty glass and observes that the service could be better. This familiar caricature of the optimist and pessimist distinguishes between two attitudes about the same thing. The optimist looks on the bright side, reveling in the good and celebrating the bright prospects for tomorrow, but the pessimist misses out on both present and future enjoyments. If we limit our understanding of optimism and pessimism to this level, we can't really see the full extent of Schopenhauer's pessimism. We might even have some trouble classifying him as a pessimist in these terms. Though Schopenhauer undoubtedly was pessimistic about many things, he didn't forego the good things in life. He took great pleasure in food and drink. He was an animated and witty conversationalist. Every day he played the flute and took a vigorous walk with his dog. And he was confident that the truth of his views would someday be recognized. Schopenhauer's pessimism addresses the nature of the world itself, not merely an individual attitude towards it. At this level, the pessimist or optimist is making a judgment about the true nature of existence. This larger context for optimism and pessimism comes out clearly in Schopenhauer's comments on the basic differences among religions.
I cannot, as is generally done, put the fundamental difference of all religions in the question whether they are monotheistic, polytheistic, or atheistic, but only in the question whether they are optimistic or pessimistic. In other words, whether they present the existence of this world as justified by itself and consequently praise and commend it, or consider it as something which can be conceived only as a consequence of our guilt, and thus really ought not to be, in that they recognize that pain and death cannot lie in the eternal, original, and immutable order of things, that which in every respect ought to be.
Though Schopenhauer is certainly no Christian, he generally agrees with what he takes to be Christianity's assessment of the world.
The power by which Christianity was able to overcome first Judaism and then the paganism of Greece and Rome is to be found solely in its pessimism, in the confession that our condition is both exceedingly sorrowful and sinful, whereas Judaism and paganism were optimistic. That truth, profoundly and painfully felt by everyone, took effect and entailed the need for redemption.
Schopenhauer says that when all's said and done, the rewards in life do not compensate for its suffering or pain. The hopefulness of birth does not overcome the infamy of death. Within religion, man's sorrowful condition creates the need for redemption. Within philosophy, it creates the need for metaphysics. Schopenhauer doesn't try to smooth things over by appealing to a just and compassionate God. He doesn't look towards an afterlife of eternal rewards, nor does he admonish us to imagine a larger perspective where the evils of the present are seen working for some greater good. For Schopenhauer, these are precisely the mistakes that various religions and other philosophers make. They want to explain evil away, to argue that what seems evil really is not so. Consider for a moment the views of the German philosopher Leibniz, who believed that our world is the best of all possible worlds. Leibniz began with three premises. One, God knows everything. Two, God created the world. And three, God is good. Before creating this world, God surveyed all the possible worlds which he could bring into existence. Through his goodness, God chose the best. Leibniz said,
"It is reasonable and certain that God will always do the best, though the less perfect does not imply a contradiction. Although God's choice of the best is certain, that does not prevent the less perfect from being and remaining possible in itself, although it will not occur. For it is not its impossibility, but its imperfection, which makes God reject it.
From this perspective, no matter how bad the evils of this world appear, we can be certain that this world's better than all other possible worlds. To think otherwise would violate our belief that God is good, all-knowing, and all-powerful. Schopenhauer doesn't gloss over the evils of human existence, nor does he justify them. Rather, he takes evils as a given. He offers an account of the world that gives them their proper place. In Schopenhauer's view, evil and suffering are central parts of the riddle of existence. This is the riddle that philosophy is supposed to solve. Schopenhauer's definition of philosophy fits this perspective in the world. He agrees with the Greek philosophers, Plato and Aristotle, that the philosophical impulse arises from a feeling of wonder or astonishment at existence. But Schopenhauer adds that it's the bad aspects of existence that cause this wonder. Aristotle, in his work Metaphysics, observed that people begin to philosophize when they become puzzled about natural phenomena. Or they may philosophize when they wonder about more weighty topics, such as the creation of the universe. The early philosophers wanted to unravel these difficulties to better understand the world, not for some practical purpose. In Aristotle's words,
"It is owing to their wonder that men both now begin and at first began to philosophize. They wondered originally at the obvious difficulties, then advanced little by little and stated difficulties about the greater matters. For example, about the phenomena of the moon and those of the sun and the stars, and about the genesis of the universe. Since they philosophized in order to escape from ignorance, evidently they were pursuing knowledge in order to know, and not for any utilitarian end."
But Schopenhauer thinks the difficulties that lead to philosophy are both more personal and more serious. Philosophy begins when we become astonished at our own existence. That existence is all the more surprising because it's going to end.
But undoubtedly, it is the knowledge of death, und there is the consideration of the suffering and misery of life, that gives the strongest impulse to philosophical reflections and metaphysical explanations of the world. If our life were without end and free from pain, it would possibly not occur to anyone to ask why the world exists and why it does so in precisely this way. But everything would be taken purely as a matter of course.
So according to Schopenhauer, we philosophize not just because we wonder at existence, but because we wonder at the pain and suffering of existence. Philosophy is not the only pursuit that tries to explain the suffering and misery of human existence. Religion also attempts to make sense of the drama of birth, life, and death. Schopenhauer, as we've seen, believes that some religions agree with his philosophical assessment that life is dismal. But he thinks we still should distinguish between philosophical and religious methods. Philosophy requires rational reflection and argumentative reasoning. This disciplined thinking is only for a few, Schopenhauer asserts. With some arrogance, he says that religions are for the masses.
Religions are exclusively for the great majority of people who are not capable of thinking, but only of believing, and are susceptible not to arguments, but only to authority.
In Schopenhauer's view, philosophy and religion differ mainly in the way beliefs are established and justified. Philosophy relies on clear and internally consistent reasoning to test the truth of its claims. Religion, however, turns to an external authority for evidence. According to Schopenhauer, religions attract their believers through signs and miracles, not arguments.
Their evidence is external, and as such is called revelation, which is authenticated by signs and miracles. Their arguments are mainly threats of eternal and indeed also temporal evils directed against unbelievers and even against mere doubters.